Welcome to the Journeyman Podcast. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
Join us as we travel from club to club, delving into the stories, tales and myths that have helped define the ethos and identities of football clubs all over the world.
We'll look at club history from all angles, whether it be the team's tactical style, superstitious fan rituals, or discussing the best players to grace the shirt.
From our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes a platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks.
We'll take you through fascinating untold stories with tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations and everything in between, and we are back.
We are here with part two of diving into FC Köln. In our first episode, in part one, we dived into the very beginnings of the club, the foundings, where they came from. We talked about Hennes Weisweiler, the manager, and we talked about, more importantly, Hennes the Goat, their lucky mascot.
And carnivals, rivalries, and lots of other things. And we're glad to be back to pick up the story from where we left off.
We're picking back up in a very golden era here, as we're going to be jumping into what would be a European Cup run in the top tier of the continental competition here with FC Köln.
So once again, having been crowned Bundesliga champions, Cologne would have a ticket into Europe's premier club competition, the European Cup.
In the first round, they would be drawn against slightly lower opposition with Icelandic team Akranes Sport Club, winning 4-1 at the Mungersdorfer Stadion and only drawing 1-1 away in Iceland, which did see the Billy Goats through, but maybe an away day in Iceland would be a bit cold and chilly, to be fair.
I'd love an Icelandic away day.
It would be pretty photogenic, I'd imagine.
Up next, slight change of scenery, was a Bulgarian team, Lokomotiv Sofia, where Cologne travelled to Bulgaria and left with a 1-0 aggregate lead. And with this advantage, they tore them at home, winning 4-0, leading them to a quarter-final matchup against Scottish giants Rangers.
The first leg in Köln will be a scrappy affair, with the midfield battle being hotly contested. The game, in all honesty, lacked a consistent thread of quality, and the only goal of the game would typify that. Just before the hour mark, Heinz Flo would take on the Rangers left-back, just near the near side. He would cut the ball back inside and loft a more hopeful than directed cross into the box.
It would sail above everyone's heads in the box towards the back post, but was invitedly nodding back into the six-yard box. The Rangers defender doesn't quite get enough to clear it away. Jürgen has two bites of the cherry, and it sets up nicely for Dieter Müller to crane his neck and head the ball home after this sort of pinball in the box moment. For Cologne fans, this gave them something to hold on to going away to Ibrox in Glasgow.
It would be Dieter Müller who would make the difference in the right place at the right time, once again away in Ibrox. Heinz Flo would whip in a dangerous cross, low at speed, and it would take a nick off another Cologne player, but the speed on the ball means all Müller had to do was direct it goalwards, which he instinctively does to double Cologne's lead in this tie. Rangers pressed to get back into the game, but they would be thwarted. Apart from some quick thinking from Thomas McLean to take a free kick quickly, while Köln's goalkeeper and the wall wasn't really set in the 86th minute to give Rangers a lifeline, but it wouldn't be enough.
Yeah, Cologne were en route to a European Cup semi-final for the first time in their history, and they were the only German team to reach the semi-final stage of all four European competitions at the time.
This feat has only been matched by one other German team, and it's not the domineering Bayern Munich. It is, in fact, Eintracht Frankfurt who have managed to get to the semi-final of all the other European competitions.
Yeah, so being at the sharp end of the top tier of continental football, yeah, usually means, you know, there's nowhere to hide from the big clubs, and this came true as Cologne came up against Brian Clough's Nottingham Forest. We'll happily be distracted by Clough's Nottingham Forest for just a minute. And we think, like, this team, they got promoted into the top division of England, won the league in their first season. But in the September of this year, they won 2-1 at Aston Villa, which broke the previous undefeated record of 34 consecutive league games, which was held by Leeds United in the 68-69 season. And a month or so later, they would beat Bolton 1-0, which would then set an undefeated record of 42 consecutive league games. And this record would stand for another 26 years, not until, I think, the Arsenal Unbeatables team broke it in the early 2000s. Pretty impressive. That's the kind of calibre this Forest team was.
And to have the first leg going away to Forest City Ground as well just makes the task even more daunting for FC Köln. Looking back on YouTube, there is a fantastic all-colour full rendition of this match available. Looking back in all its glory, you see Cluffy on the sidelines, you see the FC Köln players warming up, but the pitch is looking worst for wear, just to be polite. At the very least, it looks like an absolute bog on the pictures.
The packed-out City Ground was in full voice ahead of this important match. match, with the game kicking off at a fast pace despite the condition of the pitch. Take only 30 minutes for three goals and the woodwork to be struck twice. An absolute chaotic start to this game.
For example, in the ninth minute, Heinz Flo would work a delicate ball towards Roger Van Gool, who we mentioned in the first episode. He takes a touch just outside the 16-yard box and with no pressure pops off a shot at the near post. The ball nicks off the boggy surface and somehow clips the inside of the post to put Colne 1-0 up. Peter Shilton seemed to dive down and get a touch on it, but he couldn't deal with it, and FC Colne 1-0 up away in Nottingham.
Just 12 minutes later, Forrest worked to throw in on the near side up the field, and Colne conceded a free kick while contesting for the ball. They tried to work the ball into the box, but it sniffed out, and Colne sent an opportunity to catch them on the break. Neumann carries the ball forward from his own box just up to the halfway line before curling an offside trap breaking ball to send Van Gool away once again. The Forrest defenders race to get back, but he calmly squares it for a simple tap-in for Dieter Müller, of course. 2-0 up. And I'm sure we can use now the phrase dreamland scenario.
This was a pure smash and grab counter-attack away in Europe kind of goal. Beautiful stuff. Nottingham Forest would finally get a foothold in the game by grabbing a goal as Gary Birtles was left completely unmarked in the Colne box. And the game would continue in this end-to-end manner with players kicking lumps out of each other for good measure as they challenge for everything on this ever-worsening pitch.
Scoreline would stay the same until the 53rd minute when Forest would land a double punch just 10 minutes apart. First, Colne's defenders just stood and watched as Robertson laid up an inviting cross that was nodded down on a plate for Bowyer to smash home. Then Roberts would switch from provider to scorer as he dived to head home a fist square ball across the box, and just like that, it's 3-2 to Forest.
But continually throughout the game, Colne had joy on the counter. Forest had begun to build up pressure consistently, but would constantly leave the back door open. And this is how Colne nabbed an equaliser with 8 minutes left on the clock.
Substitute coming on, our Japanese international from last episode, Yashihiko Okidera. And he'd only been on the field a matter of moments, but he received the balls on one of Colne's quick breaks. Van Gool tried to play Okidera in behind, and the pitch took the speed off the ball, allowing the Forest defenders to sort of get back and get goal side. But Okidera was having none of it. He keeps going, one touch, whacks the ball goalwards with his right foot. Once again, takes a nick off the turf, deceives Shilton in goal as the ball flashes underneath him and into the goal. So the ground completely silent as Okidera wheels away in celebration before being absolutely mobbed by his teammates.
Nottingham Forest would push for a winner on the night, but nothing came as the final whistle blew at the end of a stellar European Cup semi-final. 3-3, and it would be all to play for heading back to Colne.
What a game.
A true showpiece game for the top tier of European football.
As you can imagine, the somewhat tense atmosphere pre-kickoff of the second game, it would be cast aside as soon as the game got underway with chances for both teams out. However, unlike the first leg, we don't have like three goals in the first however many minutes and things like that.
The first half would pass with Van Gool being the most dangerous man for Colne, attacking from the wing with his tricky dribbling as usual. This helping Colne would just about edge the first half as Müller missed a big opportunity through on goal and Konopka searching cross almost finding the corner of the goal. Come the second half, it wouldn't take long for Forrest to punish Colne for their missed chances. On the stroke of the 65th minute, a corner would be whipped into the Colne box. The ball was flicked on at the near post, falling delightfully for Bowyer in the 6-yard box. He doesn't even need to jump, bending down in fact to turn the ball past Schumacher in goal, and this puts Forrest 4-3 up on aggregate late in the tie.
Determined on home soil to swing back the game, Colne piled on the pressure, and there's one near moment when Neumann was working well down the wing. It allowed him to smash across into the box, who scrambled away back to him. He tried to tee up Flo in the 6-yard box, but he got stuck under his feet and Forrest survived another scare. Okidera would come off the bench again. This time, sadly, he volleyed one effort over the bar and couldn't find the net this time. By the end of the game, all of the 11 Forest players are all in their own half as the minutes tick down to full time. Konopka's long range effort nearly made Shilton fumble the ball into the path of a Colne striker, but wasn't to be, unfortunately.
They couldn't break down this sitting Forest defence, and it was game over for the Billy Goats. Brian Clough's men had come to the tough Mungersdorfer Arena, nicked their away goal, and got themselves over the line, unfortunately, regardless of how, to be honest, awful and not very pretty it was. They'd got the job done.
And this would end Colne's European Cup dream, and it's still the closest they've ever come to winning the biggest prize on offer in European football. And alongside this agonising defeat, the Billy Goats would fall out of the European competition the following season thanks to an underwhelming sixth place finish. But they could have the one little thing that teams take from this of like, if I have been knocked out at this point, can I at least say I got knocked out by the winner? And they can.
Because Forest would go on to win the competition in their debut year, another spectacular achievement for Brian Clough. So Colne fans can be not too disheartened for falling at this hurdle against this what would become a formidable Nottingham Forest team. However, back on German soil in the 1979-80 season, Colne would finish the decade strongly as they battled their way to an eighth DFB Pokal final. It wouldn't quite be as simple as a lovely cup run, as over the season, discontent and rumblings of change weren't far away.
The then-president, Peter Viand, expressed doubts about Weisweiler's work, and the Cologne club's management were reluctant to renew his contract. Hennes expressed his willingness to finish the season in Germany, and come the start of the 80s, Cologne were in the hunt for both a league and cup double. But these hopes would be dashed with league defeats to fellow challengers Hamburg and Bayern Munich, as part of a five-game winless streak, which saw Cologne want to take action before the end of the season, and Weisweiler decided to jump ship and accepted a contract from the New York Cosmos in February 1980.
The legendary Cologne manager would spend 2 years in America, winning the North American Super League in his first season there. But with the money-driven stars that littered his team, Weisweiler's combative style was always going to rub some teams and some players the wrong way. And it was Brazilian Carlos Alberto who accused Weisweiler of losing the Cosmos' high-profile Galactico style with his boring, conservative football.
And add to this Weisweiler's lack of publicity and media appeal, plus that the New York Cosmos officials weren't that bothered about using young American players rather than prominent international stars to promote the league. So with this breakdown, Hennes ended up leaving the States. So no goat mascot for the Cosmos, although some people maybe would argue Pelé was their goat.
He would immediately be put on the radar of Bundesliga clubs, with Eintracht Frankfurt vocalising their interest, calling Weisweiler a dream coach. But it would be a team in Switzerland that would pique Hennes' interest, as Grasshopper Club Zurich came into the picture. He signed a 2-year deal, and just like he had done in Köln, a league and cup double followed. Grasshopper defended the league title and won their first Swiss Cup in 27 years.
Very sadly, just 3 short weeks after that triumphant final, Hennes Weisweiler died at the age of 63 due to a heart attack in his house in the village just outside of Zurich. He'd intended to sort of let his career slowly fade away here and devote himself to his family and writing his memoirs. It's a massive shame that not only we lost this visionary guy at such a young age, at 63, but also we didn't get to have those memoirs of his career, and I'm sure there'd be some amazing stories in there. And
loves to have read through his memoirs whilst researching for this pod, for example, and just we can only imagine some of the behind-the-scenes stories and insights that he would have had, plus also his insights into how he'd managed to build Köln into this, and Borussia Mönchengladbach as well, sorry to admit, FC Köln fans, how he'd built both of these teams into what were European battling teams, German league-winning teams, again and again. It was, for countless years, it would have been an amazing insight into that career of his.
Even right at the end of his career there, when he goes to Zurich and he's winning their first cup for 27 years and defending the league title. Yeah, amazing. But his sudden and unexpected death resonated around the footballing world, being widely reported in the national and international press. A detailed obituary was dedicated to him by a Spanish newspaper, El Mundo Deportivo, which devoted 7 pages to the life and work of Hennes Weisweiler.
6,000 people, including numerous personalities from the worlds of sport and politics, attended his funeral, with his body being laid down in front of the Cologne Cathedral. His gravestone would bear a simple but very fitting inscription to a man that had brought many golden years to both Köln and Borussia Mönchengladbach. The inscription read, a life dedicated to football. Entgehen.
Was tun Sie dazu? Wie oft trainieren Sie?
Ja, wir trainieren genau wie alle Mannschaften in der Westdeutschen Oberliga 3-mal in der Woche. Und zwar dienstags mehr im Konditionsprogramm. Donnerstags trainieren wir taktisch. Und freitags mache ich Sondertraining, besonders Sondertraining für den Torwart.
Und vor allen Dingen legen Sie auch auf die taktische Linie der Mannschaft Wert.
Ja, ich lege besonderen Wert auf die taktische Linie und bin leider gezwungen, ich muss es ehrlich sagen, ich bin nämlich auch ein Mann, der gerne spielt. Und das habe ich wohl gerade im letzten Jahr bewiesen mit der spieltechnischen Mannschaft 1. FC Köln.
Und für die Zukunft Ihnen, Herr Weisweiler, und Ihrer Mannschaft viel, viel Glück. Sie brauchen es ja.
Recht vielen Dank.
Back in Cologne, as Hennes Weisweiler left the FC dugout for the third time, he left the club fourth in the Bundesliga and in the semi-finals of the Pokal after defeating FC Homburg, not Hamburg, as we stated in the first episode, 4-1. So FC are in a nice position here to push on and potentially get another double.
Yeah, and they would actually beat Schalke 2-0 in the semis to set up a local derby final that would serve as a chance for revenge for Dusseldorf, as it was a repeat of the final from 2 years prior. The Parkstadion in Gelsenkirchen would be the setting for this domestic final that would see Cologne take the lead just 26 minutes in, but a quick-fire double for from Rudiger Wenzel and Thomas Alof saw the cup heading back to Dusseldorf as Cologne missed out on silverware once again.
Karl-Heinz Hedegaard had been given the task of steering the Cologne ship following Hennes' departure on an interim basis, but it would be a tough task to follow in Weisweiler's footsteps. Cologne would look to hire an acclaimed name and the mastermind of total football in the 1970s with Ajax. It was the Dutchman Reinus Michels.
Known for his stints at Ajax and with the Netherlands national team, he'd been in charge of the Barcelona team that knocked Cologne out of the Cup Winners' Cup, winning 6-3. So he's certainly a man with pedigree, and he came with the price of being the highest paid coach in the Bundesliga. And he would actually find similar problems awaiting him in Germany that Ernst Happel had in our Hamburg episode, where the DFB didn't actually recognise his Dutch coach licence, saying that they wanted to protect the coaches that have acquired a licence with us, but reluctantly allowed him to join, which I'd imagine Cologne would have been fuming if they had the most expensive manager in the league that wasn't allowed to manage their team. And ahead of Rinus's first season, he had some changes he wanted to make, as the interim coach, Karl Heinz, in classic interim manager style, had basically allowed the players a lot of freedom. It reminds me of, do you know, at school when you have like a supply teacher? Like, do you know, like the classic tricks I remember at my school, like the supply teacher walks in, we've already wound the clock forward about 20 minutes, so we're going for lunch early and stuff
like
that.
You've all switched seats. Yeah. You want to sit next to your mates.
What do you mean? Like, yeah, we play games every week. You know?
Goalkeeper Toni Schumacher talked about Michels' training style, stating quite brutally, Michels was a bone-tough guy, abysmally hated and respected at the same time. The training was one torture, with gymnastics, running to the point of exhaustion, cheered on by insulting remarks like creeps, bottles, idiots. We were deeply offended, burning with rage, feeling that we were being treated like slaves, but somehow this managed to create a fire in the team that would get them running in the right direction for FC Köln.
It's not a glowing review of your manager, though. We were deeply offended, burning with rage, feeling like we were treated like slaves, all while he's shouting, creeps, bottles, yeah. Idiots. Imagine your manager calling you a bottle.
I feel like the term bottle, or he's way ahead of his time with football Twitter discourse, where literally anyone who loses a final or a semi-final is called a bottler. So for him to be using this in what was the 1980s as bottle was...
That's when I read this, I was wondering, like, is, like you said, is he a pioneer of like bottle job kind of thing? Or is he literally like comparing some of his players to like an actual physical bottle, like that's how effective they are on the field.
These methods wouldn't seem to show success either on the domestic front, as Köln finished 8th in the Bundesliga and were knocked out in the second round of the Pokal. But on the continent, in the UEFA Cup this time, is where these grueling practices would bear some fruit.
Cologne would once again be heading to Iceland as they drew the Icelandic team Akrins Sports Club, and they demolished them 10-0 on aggregate, before having to face once again FC Barcelona. But now with Rinus Michels sitting in the FC dugout, against what you'd expect the narrative to be, Cologne impressed themselves onto Barcelona, limiting the Catalans to just breaks on the counter throughout the first half. And that's exactly how Barca would make their breakthrough.
Against the run of play, Barca swiped the ball in the middle third, transitioned with pace. The ball across the box would be just hit a bit too deep for the Barcelona striker, but it also pulled the Köln keeper out of position as he tried to sweep up. And the ball would be played back towards an onrushing Quinny, who swept the ball into the top corner to punch Barcelona into the lead.
Cologne would hold on to the majority of the ball throughout the game and thus limit Barcelona's attacking output, with the majority of their chances stemming from Cologne's own passing errors. This setup did stifle Cologne's own offensive abilities, with not many clear chances being created. Barcelona would smack the inside of the post very late in the game, which proved to be another warning for Cologne.
The Billy Goats had held their own and been the more proactive team in the home stadium, but what was coming at the Nou Camp, no one would have expected.
So FC Colonia, as it would say on the Barcelona scoreboard, would run riot in Catalonia, but prior to that, Toni Schumacher would be very lucky to only receive a yellow card for a high challenge with his right foot connected with the inside thigh of a Barcelona midfielder.
It's far too close to the family jewels for my liking, and in the modern day, it's a 100% red card, even 20 years ago, let alone today. But yeah, lucky break for Toni Schumacher there.
And with that lucky break, they took full advantage, as in the 40th minute, they tried to break into the Barcelona box on the left-hand near side. It'd be sniffed out with the Barcelona defenders poking the ball just outside the box, but Gerhard Strach stood in the perfect position to collect the ball and unleash a beautiful bending and dipping effort over the goalkeeper to the far top corner with his right foot. There's nothing the keeper could do about it at all, and this brought Cologne level in the tie.
Cologne came flying out the traps as the second half kicked off. They would be rewarded as they pinched the ball off Barcelona in the attack and raced up the pitch. The ball ended up out wide, was swung back into the box with pace to find Stefan Engel with a diving header at the back post, and it put Köln 2-0 up at the Nou Camp. Just 8 minutes later, Korn grabbed another as they pulled off an audacious free kick routine straight off the training ground. The free kick taker, standing about 25 yards out from goal, rolled the ball just left of the wall to Tony Woodcock, who would then subtly backheel it into the path of Pierre Libarski, who swept home from about the penalty spot. Sensational stuff from the Pilly Goats to make it 3-1 in the tie. Dieter Müller grabbed his own goal to confirm the result and make it a historic 4-0 win away at Barcelona. Rinus Michels had demolished his former team.
And this would actually lead to an all-German tie in the last 16 against Stuttgart, in which they'd play out a 5-4 thriller with extra time even needed as well. So a real crazy game to follow on from that Barca game. The first leg played in Stuttgart would see Cologne go 1-0 up via Knopke, but they would end up actually losing 3-1. Heading back to the Müngersdorfer Stadion, Cologne had it all to do. Dieter Müller, of course, got the ball rolling with a goal in the 24th minute that set the comeback in motion.
It would take until just past the hour mark for a second as Schrack headed in from a corner, but just as momentum was starting to build, a blunder would happen. A long, easy ball would be played over the top of the Cologne defence, and that was flicked on, not dangerously, towards Knopke. He tried to head the ball onwards back towards the keeper Schumacher, but he'd already started moving to collect the ball and thus was caught wrong-footed. Both Knopke and Schumacher rushed to stop the ball rolling into an empty net, but couldn't quite reach it in time, handing Stuttgart an easy advantage. But Cologne weren't out of it just yet. They replied nearly instantly, with 1 minute later as Schrack whipped in a shot just inside the box to get the Billy Goats back on level terms.
Extra time was needed to settle this 8-goal thriller, but the winner wouldn't exactly be a peach. In the second period of extra time, Knopke would cross in a hopeful ball into the box. And it wasn't exactly sort of brimming with pinpoint accuracy as Stuttgart's defence clamoured to clear the ball. It would be knocked back and then nodded in again like a pinball machine. Regardless of the style, what's most important is that England international Tony Woodcock would just do enough to get a touch and poke it beyond the Russian Stuttgart goalkeeper.
It was all that was needed to decide this all-German classic and saw Köln progress to the quarters to face Standard Liège. 0-0 in Belgium would leave everything up to the second leg in Cologne, which needed another late comeback to progress.
Müller would get Cologne ahead, but two goals from Standard Liège flipped the tie, and it would take a Rainer Bonhof penalty in the 70th minute plus an 88th minute winner from Lidbarski to send Cologne through again in the most unlikely fashion.
Sie kämpfen, fordern die Fans. Einige Spieler scheinen es nicht zu hören, habe ich den Eindruck. Aber der FC hat das Glück. Lidbarski, 4 Minuten vor dem Ende, vielleicht doch noch das glückliche Ende für den FC. Lidbarski, 3-2.
They'd be rewarded with a semi-final tie that we've already mentioned, as is what's got us talking about Cologne in the first place. They would face Sir Bobby Robson's Ipswich Town, and this would be the stage Cologne would bow out, losing 1-0 in both legs. Once again, potential European glory is stifled out. And once again to a legendary English manager at the peak of their powers, arguably.
Back for Russell Osman, marking again so tight in that penalty area. Gates off his knee, a rare lapse of control, but he does well to get it wide for Mills. And there's Rock! The man with a magic touch is there again.
However, FC Köln fans would have to wait another 2 years for some form of silverware to return to Köln, despite all these near misses. But when they saw who they'd be facing in the 1983 DFB Pokal final, well, the silverware was always going to be coming back to Köln as they faced off against Bundesliga 2 side Fortuna Köln.
It was the 40th season of Germany's knockout football cup competition, and this final has the unique trait of being the first and to date the only German cup final between two teams from the same city, with the game fittingly taking place at the Müngersdorfer Stadion. So this is a real Cologne fixture. It's in Cologne, two Cologne teams. You can just imagine what the atmosphere or the war was like on the streets of Cologne going up to this game.
Fortuna Köln had done FC Köln a favour in knocking out Gladbach in the quarterfinals and then dumped out Dortmund 5-0 in the semis. So despite coming from the second tier, Fortuna were on a real hot streak coming into this final.
Yeah, and they'd carve out a chance really early on that would have Cologne keeper Tony Schumacher scrambling as the defence covered back. The underdogs would leave the crossbar rattling as an effort from 40 yards flew over the Cologne defence after clearing a corner. Fortuna would give it their all, but as the game wore on, Cologne's quality began to shine. A nice outside of the foot pass got the ball into the near side of the 16-yard box, ready for a teasing cross that Fortuna's keeper just couldn't quite clear, and the ball would fall perfectly for Lidbarski to jab home.
That's how the game would finish, as Köln won their fourth and still most recent DFB Pokal. Some great scenes on the videos about this game, as Köln players completely fill the Pokal with champagne, and in fact it takes just under 3 bottles, it looks like, to fill the entirety of that massive golden trophy, with champagne.
Good knowledge to have, isn't it? How many bottles of champagne does it take to fill the Pokal?
We'd much rather champagne or beer being filled than Red Bull last time. That was not a very nice sight to see with RB Leipzig filling it disgustingly with that disgusting energy drink. So please, can a proper German team fill it with some beer next time? That's what we'd like to see.
But back on the continent, the closest the Billy Goats have ever come to some form of European glory would come once again in the UEFA Cup. Cologne beat the likes of Sporting Gijon, Bohemians Prague, Hammarby and Sporting CP en route to the semi-final stage once again.
This time the West Germans would come in the semi-finals as favourites, facing up against a Belgian side we'd both never heard of in KSV Waregem.
Cologne's record at the Mungersdorfer Stadion was the foundation of this cup run, and throughout the entire competition, the West German side conceded only one goal whilst playing at home, so seriously good home record, that's ridiculous.
A dominant 4-0 win came in the semis as the Belgian side failed to land a punch on the Billy Goats.
With this big advantage, you'd be excused for thinking that the second leg in Belgium would turn into a dead rubber, but you'd be mistaken as the teams played out a 3-3 draw.
Cologne took the lead through Klaus Allofs, and just 10 minutes later, he'd get the double a two. A quick double from Congolese national Luvia Mutombo got Waregem back level, but then Allofs was given the opportunity to complete his hat-trick from the spot, which he did with aplomb.
Armin Goetz would smash home a free kick in the 78th minute to level the game once again, but it wouldn't be any more than a consolation, with the tie ending 7-3 on aggregate. The then two-legged final beckoned for Cologne as Real Madrid fought off Inter Milan in the other semi. Both of these teams on the route to the final had ridiculous home records. Like we said, Real Madrid had won all five of their home games with 19 goals, only conceding two. Cologne dominant in all of their home fixtures, only conceding one goal whilst playing as the home team. And on the way to getting there, Real Madrid actually achieved a shock comeback against two-time champions Borussia Mönchengladbach. They were absolutely crushed by Gladbach in the away leg by a score of 5-1. And Real stormed back to win the return leg 4-0 and thus advanced on away goals. And this is actually still regarded as one of the greatest comebacks in the history of European football.
Unfortunately for Cologne, the first leg would also be played in Madrid. But with this being the furthest the Billy Goats had ever been in Europe, they flew out the blocks and even grabbed an unlikely 1-0 lead.
Talisman Klaus Allofs would collect the ball centrally and drive at the Real defence before unleashing a powerful effort that would silence the home crowd.
Allofs, Vorteil, richtig. Klaus Allofs macht das 1-0 für den ersten FC Köln.
However, this is where things would start to take a turn sour in the first ever final, as Real Madrid would make it 1-1 just 10 minutes later, and then 2-1 5 minutes after that.
Cologne would get back into the change of room, just one goal behind. Just 6 minutes into the second half, Jorge Valdano would make it 3-1 before Real Madrid really rubbed salt into the wound with another two goals in the last 10 minutes to make it 5-1.
The last goal being particularly bruising, as a Cologne goal kick was headed straight back at them. The looping heading pass cut through the middle of the Cologne defence as Santillana would be able to bounce the ball on his head, shrug off a covering Cologne defender, leaving him on the turf before firing under Schumacher in goal.
Los Blancos had really used that home advantage to almost put the tie out of sight completely in one single leg. But Cologne had their home advantage possibly to stage a fight back. Right?
Actually wrong. So because Cologne fans had been accused of causing trouble in Belgium during the second leg of the semi-final, UEFA had punished them by forcing them to play at least 350 kilometres away from their home stadium. So thus, the second leg of the final was played at the Olympiastadion in Berlin. And this put Cologne at such a disadvantage that the Cologne players themselves apparently walked through Berlin to try and get as many spectators as possible for the final, with only 16,000 turning out for the game, which is crazy, isn't it? Imagine Lewandowski walking up to you in the street and asking, like, please will you come watch me in the Europa League final?
Like, handing you a ticket, like, it's only 10 euros, mate, you can come and enjoy yourself, please. We're playing Real Madrid as well. Like, it's such a weird timeline to think of, that idea of that they couldn't fill the Olympiastadion at all.
Very, very strange. Maybe in part it was made harder to get to because it was still in a divided Germany, maybe. But
however, despite this change in scenery and the deficit they faced, Cologne kicked off and played better football from the start. They kept the ball well and didn't allow Real to create anything before grabbing their own first goal just 22 minutes in.
A lovely header from Uwe Bain got the imaginations of Cologne fans dreaming of a dramatic cup final comeback.
1-0 on the night to Cologne, but three more goals were needed to win it.
Real goalkeeper Agustin would be called into action several more times in the first half. And he would start the second half as he's ended the first, tipping over a powerful free kick early doors before smothering a chance after the resulting corner.
Cologne rode their luck at points as Madrid picked their moments to try and get forward and had some chances fly across the face of goal, but Cologne would get themselves a second through Geilenkirchen. He would pop up at the back post and rifle home, so maybe, just maybe, here in Berlin, this comeback could be on.
And Alof's curling effort from a free kick would bounce wide just moments later. The chance would come. From a free kick wide on the near side, Alof would deliver a teasing ball into the box. Three Real Madrid defenders clamber to head it. All of them bundle into one as the ball gets passed. It falls to Gael Kerkin, completely unmarked on the edge of the six-yard box. All the Real defenders turn to this midfielder. He has enough time to take a touch. Nothing but the goalkeeper standing in his way.
The almost empty goal looms. An effort either side of the Real Madrid goalkeeper would put Coln right back into this tie. But unfortunately, Ralph couldn't do anything more than fire the ball right at Augustin. Gael Kerkin holds his head in his hands as he knows how good of a chance it was. Alof's on the near side, falls to his knees in disappointment. Coln then keep knocking on the door for the last minutes, but nothing budges as the tie finishes 5-3 to Real Madrid, and they lift the trophy in their purple Parmalat-sponsored away kit.
How we mentioned Alof fell to the ground in despair after the sitter was missed. Well, you couldn't blame him as he'd finished actually the top goal scorer in the cup with 9 goals, so he'd done everything personally he could. And just like that, Coln had been dismissed at the highest ever point in a European journey, and still a height that they've yet to ever reach again. What could have been if that goal went in?
Possibly, they could have had a magical night away at the Olympiastadion in Berlin, but unfortunately, yeah, Ralph couldn't find the net either side of the goalkeeper, unfortunately, and that's the, as we've already said, the highest point that FC Coln had ever reached in a European journey, so a long way to go to get back to there, even in the modern day.
After that sort of close finish and being so close, they're so nearly getting that silverware in the following years, from sort of 1986 to 90, they would get two more second place finishes in the leagues and just not quite getting there. Despite this almost fairy tale run at European glory, the national competition proved to be a bit of a disaster as they'd flirted with relegation and once again finishing 13th, but just 1 point clear of the relegation playoff with a 3-0 win versus Bochum on the final day needed to secure their spot in the Bundesliga.
The following season didn't start well either, as after 7 games they only achieved 1 win and were in sitting in 16th place. They sacked the coach and achieved a solid mid-table finish, but this wasn't the most controversial sacking of the season.
The publication of goalkeeper Toni Schumacher's book Anpfiff in 1987 caused a scandal in Germany, which meant the end of his time in Cologne and in the national team.
Nowadays, it barely even gets into the news cycle when a football player releases a book, even with some mad or controversial takes. But this book was really, really controversial for the time. It detailed things like massive doping accusations and attacks against some of his former and fellow teammates.
Sounds like he was just the Prince Harry of his time. But the club acted quickly to suspend Schumacher, and just like that, his 15-year spell in Cologne was brought to an end. He'd made 422 appearances for the club, and this was mid-season as well, so all this upheaval really wouldn't have helped the club. And just to sort of put it into context, in the 2 years prior, in 1984 and 1986, Schumacher was actually voted Germany's Footballer of the Year. In addition, FIFA had chosen him the silver ball for the second best player at the 86 World Cup. He was a main player, a real star. This is why it was such big news.
We talked about him constantly throughout these successful periods at FC Coln. He would later play for the likes of Schalke, Fenerbahce, Bayern Munich and Dortmund.
Ahead of the 87-88 season, talisman Klaus Alof and goalscorer in the UEFA Cup final Uwe Bien would both leave Cologne. And you have to think losing those two huge figures would be pivotal, and it turned out to be that way. They lost in the DFB Pokal in the second round to Victoria Aschaffenburg.
Which, as you could tell there from Mark's subpar pronunciation, we didn't know this team, to be honest, and we couldn't find at what level they were playing at back then, but they're currently in the 10th tier of German football, so we can't imagine this would have been a good look for FC Coln either way.
I just Googled it while you were talking. It's a tiny little place near Frankfurt.
So yeah, definitely not a good look for FC Coln, confirmed there from Mark.
In the Bundesliga, things would be surprisingly upbeat as Cologne would contest and battle for the league. They'd only sit in pole position in game weeks 11 and 12 as Werder Bremen and Bayern Munich proved to be the challengers, finishing ahead of them. But third place was a massive improvement on a relegation battle the year before.
They'd even go one better following the domestic campaign. They climbed into second place, losing out to none other than Bayern Munich. Klaus Alof's brother, Thomas Alof, joined the club a few seasons prior and became as potent in front of goal as his brother did. During the 88-89 campaign, he'd become the Bundesliga top scorer, joint with Bayern's Roland Wohlfarth with 17 goals. This is to date the last time an FC player has finished the season as top scorer in the goal-scoring Bundesliga charts.
Despite his goal-scoring exploits, Cologne would lose Thomas Alof, but once again, surprisingly, the team continued to perform in the league. They'd compete once again for the title, sitting top on three separate occasions, but in the final third of the season, Bayern ran away with it once again, which sounds like a very familiar story, finishing 6 points clear of the Billy Goats.
And this is where we move in into sort of the 1990s and the kind of unfortunate slide of FC Köln starts to begin. As we mentioned in part one with the unfortunate passing of Franz Kramer, who is the talisman that created this team with his drive, with his focus to make sure that they were competitive in every format. Since his passing, it's just never, ever been matched, has it, Mark?
No, not at all. And it's that recurring thing that we sort of pick up on a lot in these podcasts of when you lose such pivotal and influential figures, and it's like, how you move on from that, how do you carry on?
And as it says here, come the turn of the 90s, this would mark, as noted on Köln's Wikipedia, as the end of the glorious 30-year period for FC Köln. So that really sums up like what's coming over the next decade for FC Köln, unfortunately. As for the club had been founded to compete for trophies, and in this decade they would simply be starved of opportunities to do so.
A single Pokal final appearance, which they lost to Werder Bremen on penalties, was the only chance in 1991, still just about using the momentum of the successful 80s. And to add to this, financial difficulties began to plague the club. And the president actually resigned, and under his successor, Klaus Hartmann, problems with money started to occur even more. And I'd have to imagine that, you know, the lack of then getting European football and things like that, as the club is all of a sudden really starting to struggle.
In the same way that Franz Kramer had created a virtuous circle of constant upward mobility, buying new players, they perform better, they get a higher place in the league, they get some more players, thanks to the likes of Hennes Weisweiler as well, and Rinus Michels. However, when things start going the other way, you drop out of Europe, you lose some money, you sell a player, quality of the squad goes down, and it just starts going backwards and backwards.
And this got to the point where it's even as far as nearly jeopardising the granting of a licence to play in the Bundesliga. Crazy to think, just a few seasons before, Cologne had pocketed a then record fee of 14 million Deutschmarks from Juventus for Thomas Hassler. And Hassler had made over 140 appearances in Cologne and won over 100 caps for Germany. Interesting sort of little side stories that we'd like to find on the journeyman. Later in his career, Thomas Hassler, he hit in the headlines at 1860 Munich, or should I say his marriage hit the headlines when it turned out his manager was having an affair with his wife, and 1860 Munich fired them out. This is the first time I've ever heard of a manager being fired for having an affair with one of his players' wives.
This blows John Terry and Wayne Bridges' scandal out of the water completely.
But it wasn't all bad for Thomas Hassler, because by January 2017 he participated on the 11th season of I'm a Celebrity, Getting Me Out of Here, the German edition, and taking fourth place.
I'm sure that healed some wounds, having to go out to the jungle, in the German jungle. Or German jungle? Or the German version of the jungle out in Australia or New Zealand.
The German jungle. It's like a place in like Dresden or something.
With the financial irregularities building at FC Köln, it was not known how FC had even gotten themselves into the situation, despite having what was known as the Hassler millions. Details of the transfer with Juventus could never be clarified, but it was one of the leading factors towards then-president Artzinger Bolton's resignation.
The club managed to consolidate itself by slashing the budgets and money available, but in doing so naturally lost pace with the top of the Bundesliga. Things went badly at first in the 91-92 season, when Erich Ruttmüller would resign as a manager after a weak start. But after a point in Jörg Berger, the club climbed the table and finished fourth, claiming a UEFA Cup spot in what was probably the biggest highlight of this decade, to be honest.
Despite the relative success, the season was overshadowed by the death of Maurice Banach. The 24-year-old striker was considered a very promising player for both Köln and the German national team, and he had unfortunately passed during a traffic accident on his way to training.
So he was the son of a German father and a US soldier. He was considered one of the most promising strikers in the late 80s, early 90s in Germany, and he'd scored 24 goals in 49 games for Cologne. He scored his last two goals on November 9th, 1991, at home in the Mungesdorfer Stadion in a 4-1 win over Fortuna Düsseldorf. And a week later, he played the last game of his professional career away at Schalke. After the game, he'd agreed not to return to Cologne with the team, but to stay in his hometown of Munster. He set off from there for training the next morning, and sadly, that was on the journey. He had his accident, and the upcoming game against Dresden was cancelled by Cologne as a mark of respect, and the international match of the German national team had like a minute silence for the game against Belgium.
So even when FC Köln might have had a sliver of hope for a young up-and-coming player to drive them to new successes, unfortunately, this unfortunate accident took that away from them. The following 92-93 season saw them dragged into a relegation battle to boot, once again confirming safety with a game to spare, but they'd have four different coaches in the dugout throughout that season.
A distinct sign that the club were facing difficult times is that between 1990 and 1998, nine different coaches were in the dugout. just as many that they'd had previously between 1973 and 1990, which says a lot about the sort of the situation at the club and how there's very little stability. And
this was a very clear sign in our HSV episode when they started rattling through managers constantly every single season or every half season before their eventual relegation as Dear Dino. So we're seeing it here again at FC Köln, and it's not looking good.
Yeah, it's never a good sign, and that sort of set the tone for the coming years, really. Cologne basically becoming a bit of a yo-yo club. The 1997-98 season loomed. The financial restrictions were still lingering in the background, and Klaus Hartmann was replaced by Albert Kaspers.
He was tasked with introducing professional management and thus making sporting success possible again in a similar vein to what Franz Kramer had achieved all those years ago. Trying to follow the kind of cliche Köln DNA kind of idea, this feels like.
Big shoes to try and step into. In the DFB Cup before the season started, the team was knocked out in round one with a 3-1 defeat to regional league side SSV Ulm. Not a good way to start the season. Bundesliga got underway and things didn't start well there either, as Cologne were stuck in the bottom half from the start, picking up just 7 points from the first 8 games.
This led to the manager's departure midway through the season, so again, they're not breaking this cycle, and he would be replaced by Lorenz Günther Kostner. Things would solidify under his tenure as he led the team into mid-table mediocrity just before the 30th match day.
With 6 games to go, FC sat 5 points clear of the drop. Despite boasting a good record at home, both Karlsruhe and 1860 Munich, who sat behind Köln in the league, managed to win at the Müngersdorfer Stadion and thus set distant alarm bells ringing. Schalke would also be visitors to Köln in a tense and edgy game with little quality between the two teams, but one incident would come to haunt FC.
From a wide set piece, the ball would be played into the box. A rabble of players plus the Schalke goalkeeper tried their best to connect with the ball, but it would just dribble out into the path of a Köln midfielder. With the goalkeeper in no man's land, he hit the ball on target before Schalke's Oliver Held somehow got a touch to it over the bar. The Köln players surround the referee, claiming in anger, "Handball, handball, ref." And on the replay, it clearly shows that he had used his hand in vintage Luis Suarez style to put the ball over the bar, and somehow the ref only awards a corner, somehow. Whilst this is all going on, it's holding his face on the floor as well. So it's absolutely, unfortunately, hilarious for FC Köln that this isn't given as a clear penalty.
Absolute textbook shithousery, isn't it? That to add to the injustice, in the last minute, Schalke pumped the ball up long and somehow, with a combination of quick passes, found a pocket of space in the middle of the Köln box. Despite heavy pressure from the defenders, Radoslav Latal gets a P-roller of a shot away that's turned, deflected, and tragically dribbles in with a light kiss of the far post. For Schalke, it's dreamland, and for Cologne, this is just depressing. And when you're on that side of a result in football, I'm sure everybody's team has felt it, that kind of thing, and it's just, yeah, horrible.
I hope you take notice of the words we use to try and describe how tragically this ball rolls over the line, because it's not powerful. It's an absolute P-roller, to repeat it. It's just woeful for FC Köln. Pure head-in-hands despair moment for the FC Köln fans, I'm sure.
This led to the next game being a must-win as they played against already relegated Arminia Bielefeld. It would be former FC player Uwe Fuchs who would score the winner for Bielefeld and thus all but confirm Cologne's relegation, as even with a win on the final day, their significantly worse goal difference condemned them to the second tier.
FC Köln had been a mainstay of the top flight of German football, staying there for 49 consecutive years before their eventual relegation. And as we've seen in recent years, the second tier of German football isn't a walk in the park.
Yeah, and they had to contend with major upheaval as well. 16 players left the club, 9 joined, and another new manager in the dugout, as former player Bernd Schuster took over the team. Being knocked out by Hansa Rostock in the first round of the DFB Pokal wasn't worrying enough, and it was full panic stations after 6 games into the season. The Billy Goats sat in 17th place, second from bottom.
Losing 4-1 against St. Pauli and 6-1 against Hannover 96 are both noted as particularly awful games in that first stint of the season. But a 3-2 win away at Energy Cottbus proved to be a catalyst to stabilising the season, and Köln lifted themselves to finish comfortably in 10th. In a conflicting sense, this would be a relief as they managed to stop the free fall mid-season, but this was still, and is, Köln's worst ever finishing position in the history of the club.
For the following season, Bernd Schuster was replaced by Ewald Lienen, and this would spark life back into the club. The Billy Goats went on to win the Bundesliga 2 title, 4 points clear of Bochum, leading the table from game week 11 until the end of the season. And they could take great pleasure in stopping Mönchengladbach getting back up as they dropped into the second tier the year after Köln's relegation.
Köln returned to the Bundesliga would be capped off with a solid 10th place finish. But as we move into the new millennium, this would signal a shift downwards in achievements and expectations around the club as they began to bounce between the first and second tiers of Germany with continued regularity.
After their 10th place finish in the 2000-2001 season, they'd be relegated once again, setting an unwanted Bundesliga record in the process too. In November 2001, the Billy Goats would score in the 33rd minute in their Bundesliga tie versus St. Pauli. This would be the last goal their fans would actually get to celebrate for 1,033 minutes, or roughly 10.5 consecutive games, before this goal drought would end in March 2002 with a goal versus Hertha Berlin, which is quite fitting for modern times right now. After being relegated in 02-03, they'd achieved promotion straight back to the Bundesliga at the first attempt with a second place finish. I'm getting strong West Brom, Birmingham City vibes, early 2000s, Premier League, kind of just up and down, up and down.
As they went into the 2003-04 season, they would not be able to shake these Birmingham City vibes that Mark just described, and they stared relegation in the face once again. But one up-and-coming player would make their debut and an impact on the first team straight away. Can you guess who we're talking about? It is none other than German international Lukas Podolski.
Polish-born Lukas Podolski had joined the Cologne Academy at the age of 10 years old. But it wasn't until he was 18 and the club was struggling to keep its Bundesliga status that then-manager Marcel Koller invited the striker to train with the first team. He'd impressed in the youth football, scoring 8 goals in 8 games, and would continue to impress in first-team training. He was duly rewarded with a full professional contract, and just 11 days later, he was fast-tracked to make his professional debut. It's one of those situations of clearly, like, it was the right place and the right time. Like, he was clearly, I don't know, good enough and ready, but that probably also tells you how desperate Cologne probably were at this time as well.
That this young kid is blowing goals past them in training and that they need him to be in the first team straight away shows that, yeah, as you said, the level that FC Cologne have unfortunately fallen to. He'd grab his first goal for FC 3 games later in a 1-1 draw against Hansa Rostock. Despite Cologne being in dire straits for majority of the season, the newcomer nabbed 10 goals in 19 games. This was something no other 18-year-old had ever achieved in the Bundesliga era, so we're talking about pure wonder kid stuff here.
Pretty astonishing. But unfortunately, despite getting those 10 goals in 19 games, his goals wasn't enough to save Cologne from relegation. Probably the biggest, the most surprising thing there is actually he would then stay with Cologne into the second division to fire them back, getting 24 goals in 30 games and getting them straight back up again with the title in the process.
He would power the Billy Goats to that top spot in the second tier. But when you look at Podolski's family history, it starts to make sense of how he was able to hit the ground running in Cologne, as he was born in Gliwice, Poland. He was the son of a German-born footballer, Waldemir Podolski, and his mother was a former handball player, Krystyna Podolska, who'd represented the Polish national team of handball. So there's 100% some good sporting genes in that Podolski lifeline there, for sure.
In the 05-06 season, Podolski again managed to get a double-digit goal haul, but his 12 goals for the season were once again not enough to keep Cologne in the league. And this time, the striker cited another relegation to the second Bundesliga as his main reason for wanting to now leave Cologne. Clubs such as Real Madrid and Liverpool were noted for their interest in the young striker, while also Hamburg, Werder Bremen also registered their interest. So there's a lot of teams are interested in this young striker, this young asset. As the club's getting relegated, he's there as the eagles start to swarm.
You could imagine with Hamburg and Werder's executives specifically being too busy squabbling with each other about their own northern rivalry to get any deal done with amongst like the pressure of the biggest clubs circling for Lukas Podolski's signature here. But it would be those Bavarians that struck a successful deal for the goal-scoring gem at €10 million. And he wouldn't be the only change at the club either. Prior to the season starting, there'll be a total of 18 departures and 14 arrivals in Cologne.
And of course, it wouldn't be that kind of situation without a new manager also coming on board. And they would finish 9th in the second tier. Meanwhile, Podolski would join a strike force of Roy Mackay, Claudio Pizarro and Rocky Santa Cruz, where Podolski would struggle to hold down a first team spot. He'd play 22 times in the Bundesliga, but with 11 of those appearances coming from the bench. And what wouldn't help is picking up an ankle problem in training caused by Matt van Bommel, which would see him miss 5 weeks as Bayern slumped to a 4th place finish in the Bundesliga.
Just have to note some stunning names there with Roy Mackay, Claudio Pizarro and Rocky Santa Cruz. Vintage strikers from back in the day there. But the Bayern hierarchy clearly thought change was needed as they shipped out Pizarro and Mackay and set up a new potent duo in Munich, composed of legendary striker Miroslav Klose and Italian talisman Luca Toni. Toni would rack up 39 goals in all competitions alone, with Klose on 21 as this fired Bayern to a league and cup double, giving Podolski his first major silverware in his career.
He would make 42 appearances that season in all competitions, but certainly was second fiddle to the duo of Luka Toni and Miroslav Klose, like you say. Back in Cologne, their second season in their second tier didn't start well, as they'd be dumped out of the cup in the first round at the hands of Werder Bremen's B team. After that bumpy start, they got themselves back in gear and up the table, and actually confirmed the promotion back to the top division on the penultimate match day against Mainz with a 2-0 win.
Despite the success of the six promotions in the club history, this one was the worst in terms of the table position in third place, points scored with only 60, and distance to the first non-promotion place being just 2 points. So still not great times for FC Köln, really struggling here in the second tier.
Podolski and Cologne would actually cross paths when Bayern travelled to Cologne on game week 4. Despite Klinsmann becoming the new head coach at Munich, Podolski was still limited to a bit part role, but he came off the bench against his old club around the hour mark to replace Klose just after Bayern went 1-0 up. Toni would get another, and while in the last minute Podolski grabbed one of his own against his former club, which is... that's got to hurt, hasn't it?
Throughout the season, Köln, thankfully in the top tier of the Bundesliga, pottered along in kind of mid-table security, but Bayern and thus Lucas struggled to take their normal spot at the top of the Bundesliga.
Bayern pulled together an unbeaten run leading up to and throughout the Christmas time, going 11 games without a loss, Podolski grabbing just one goal in this run. Two losses in three games came in the new year, destroyed this momentum, and then the Bavarians hosted Cologne with Podolski in the starting 11.
The nervous energy around the stadium could be felt as an early Novakovic header flashed across goal. Köln would receive some luck as Klose headed home, but the linesman wrongly flags for offside, and this is a dose of luck that the Burly Goats take full advantage of on the counter.
Fabrice Ehret would beat Martin Demichelis for pace and poke around Michael Rensin to put Cologne 1-0 up 22 minutes in, and just 10 minutes later with Bayern on the ropes, FC would double the lead with some nice wing play led to a neat ball being played into the Bayern box for Daniel Brzezinski to slot home calmly to 2-0 up against Bayern.
Fucicevic for Bayern Land, and that is the 2-0 für den ersten FC Köln. Und das gibt's doch gar nicht. Der Newcomer trifft bei seinem Bundesliga-Debüt für den FC Daniel Brzezinski.
As the second half wore on, the Köln keeper would be called into action to deny waves of attack from the Bavarians. Van Buyten would finally beat the Köln goalkeeper with 5 minutes to go, but it wouldn't be enough. FC claimed a valuable win in Munich. Meanwhile, Podolski didn't leave a single mark on the game.
Der FC siegt 2-1 bei den Bayern und jetzt werden sie in Köln den Rosenmontag um 2 Tage vorverlegen.
5 games left of the season, Klinsmann was relieved of his duty with Jupp Heynckes taking over, and this saw Podolski's form pick up with 2 goals and 5 assists. But alas, Lucas had already been organising a dramatic return to Cologne during the winter break of that season.
After being assured by national team coach Joachim Löw that his return to FC wouldn't hurt his chances of being selected for the German national team, an agreement was struck for €10 million. In a bid to finance this move, Köln created a website where people were able to buy pixel images of Podolski for €25 per 8x8 pixel sized square in order to gather an extra €1 million to reduce the cost of this transfer.
Formula One driver and Cologne supporter Michael Schumacher bought several pictures for €875. It just got us thinking, is this the first NFT in football?
Yeah, when we're currently living in an era where every football team is giving away little digital pictures of their players in sort of cartoon ways, we're Köln breaking ground in the internet era here back in the day to try to get this fee lowered for Podolski's return.
Despite Podolski's return, this didn't spark a grand revival of either his or Cologne's form, and he would be remarkably inaccurate, only netting 3 times across the entire season as the Billy Goats finished 13th in the league. But one of Podolski's few goals did come against the Bavarian Giants as they were held to a 1-1 draw at the home of Cologne.
I can imagine that Lucas would have been massively pumped for that game at the very least if he wasn't in the best of form throughout the rest of the season. That is the one game I'm sure he would want to have left his mark on.
Especially when he looked to the stands and saw all the fans with their 8x8 pixel images waving them down there. Do you reckon they still have, what happened to them? I want to know. Any Cologne fans who bought some pixels to fund Podolski's transfer, please get into it.
Podolski, however, would regain his form in the following 09-10 season, scoring 13 goals and making 7 assists. But again, Cologne would be stuck firmly in mid-table mediocrity with a 10th placed finish.
Podolski's personal upward trajectory would continue to climb as he netted 18 goals, finishing the joint fourth top goal scorer. But as he sort of was on this rise, the Billy Goats were actually in free fall as they slumped heavily in the second half of the season, and this led to the club's fifth relegation, 1 point from the playoff spot, but five from actual safety, so finishing in 17th place. And the club actually had accumulated by this point a €33 million worth of debt.
And thus Podolski had suffered his third relegation with the Billy Goats, and it was time for him to move on once again, this time to the Premier League beckoned for the Pole.
Of course, Arsenal paid €15 million to bring the striker to the Emirates, and he finished his first season at Arsenal with a total of 16 goals and 11 assists. He'd follow that with 12 in the next season, but then only 3 after that, as he moved on loan to Inter Milan in search of more time on the pitch.
This led him to leaving England for Turkey, as Galatasaray picked him up for €1.8 million and helped guide them to the Turkish Super League title, also netting a decisive goal in a 1-0 win over arch-rivals Fenerbahce in the Turkish Cup final.
That's like instant hero status in Turkey, isn't it? He then made moves to Japan with Vissel Kobe and returned back to Turkey with Antalyaspor, and he now plays in the Polish League with Górnik Zabrze.
This is particularly touching as it's the team he followed as a boy, being born in the Polish town of Gliwice, located next to Zabrze. He also stated in 2012, "While at Arsenal, I follow all of Górnik's matches on TV or live on the internet, and I'm very happy that a new stadium is being built in Zabrze. My dream is to play at those facilities," and he has fulfilled that, playing 42 times to date and netting 12 goals.
One of our favourite stories about Podolski has to be him opening up his own kebab shop in Cologne called Mangal Döner. An opening night, hundreds of people packed out to get a taste of his Prince Poldi kebabs. It's said that Podolski acquired the taste for Turkish cuisine during his two-year spell with Galatasaray in Istanbul, and he's added this to his restaurant portfolio business in Cologne, along with a clothing store and an ice cream parlour named Ice Cream United. And actually, I've also tried some Podolski crisps that you can buy here in Germany, and they were very, very good.
What flavour were they, Mark?
They're Podolski kebab flavoured crisps.
Okay, that is... Where did you get these?
Reva.
No, it's just
a supermarket.
Oh, fair enough. Nice and easy.
You should guess. They're actually really good. Sorry, we're getting sidetracked here, but they're very good.
This is a live discovery. I have got something to add to the shopping list tomorrow anyway. But please let us know, FC Köln fans, if you have managed to go to Mangal Döner, please let us know how good are the kebabs. Obviously, with us being based here in Berlin, we are Döner mad. We love the Döner kebab. So please let us know, FC Köln fans, let us know. How does it taste? How is it?
Definitely let us know. Give us some food envy, and I'll send you the link for the crisps.
Since Poldi's departure from FC, the club have kind of struggled for leading figures. You could even pull this all the way back to Franz Kramer, really, if you really wanted to, as they've rattled through 7 managers in 10 years. But the latest man in the dugout seems to be creating a unique atmosphere around the club, and it's none other than Stefan Baumgart.
Stefan, just to sort of sum up his character, he said one of his quotes about playing Bayern Munich: "If I sit in the back, I can get my ass kicked just as much. I just want to have fun." So yeah, he seems like a very fun, cool character, doesn't he?
Quite a down-to-earth fella.
And when he joined the club, he surprised fans and onlookers with not only wanting Cologne to avoid relegation, but also to belong to the 12 best teams in the league, and all that with a squad that had sort of barely justified its Bundesliga quality in recent times and hadn't been really improved at all in the summer. And he impressed during a significant stint at Paderborn, in which he'd guided them through 2 promotions from the Dreiliga up to the second division, and against all odds to the top tier in the space of 3 seasons.
As we love to see here on the Journeyman podcast, he's had a pretty modest German journeyman playing career. Being born in Rostock in northern eastern Germany, he started his youth career as a striker with Dynamo Rostock Mitte, before featuring for lower league clubs like PSV Schwerin and SPVG Aurich. He made it back to the biggest club in his hometown with Hansa Rostock, playing 118 times whilst netting 28 goals in his time there.
Yeah, and he'd get a 1-year stint at Wolfsburg before returning to Hansa. Then he had his most productive period as a player with Union Berlin between 02 and 04, playing 64 games and netting 22 times. He'd play for 3 more clubs over 5 years with Energie Cottbus, Magdeburg, and lastly Germania Schöneiche.
For those of you who don't know the kind of Eastern German geography, he stayed very close to us here in like Berlin and the territories north of Berlin as well. So he's a very local man to the likes of Union and Hansa Rostock. He swiftly jumped into management with FC Magdeburg, which is a club not far from outside of Berlin, where he lasted 1 year before going off the radar for several years. But he resurfaced in Berlin as a manager of Berliner AK07, which are based in Mitte, around 5 kilometers or so from where we're recording this podcast right now.
Before then moving to Paderborn, which as mentioned is where he really began to shine with his attacking style of play. He says that he wants to come across as a unit, not only within the team, but also around it. In an article on The Athletic we were reading, saying after all, Cologne doesn't only go into a frenzy once a year at carnival time, but also when it comes to the city's beloved football club, a club known for being restless and prone to chaos. So it sort of sounds like he's the perfect man to try and pull all of this together.
FC Köln's sports director, Jörg Jacobs, states, it's not like he's waved a magic wand and everything has just started to work because of his charisma. There has been a lot of work behind it. When he came, he already had his ideas on how he wanted to play, and then he figured out how the players would be able to fit into that mould. So taking it step by step in building FC Köln back to what they used to be.
However, the transition from a sort of reactive team to a proactive team wasn't completely seamless, as highlighted by an unlucky patch with only 1 win in 9 games. During this time, Baumgart made some adjustments to his increasingly predictable setup, installing new positioning and passing patterns before the ball arrived on the wings, but there was another issue.
At the beginning of Baumgart's tenure, the team only managed to average the likes of 46% possession, the 7th lowest in the Bundesliga. Then the following season, they suddenly jumped up to 4th with 56% possession, and players who weren't used to having much of the ball were suddenly trusted to with build-up play from the back, and because of this, mistakes would be unavoidable. But regardless, Stefan Baumgart stated, it's fun to watch the games in the stadium. We want to go down this path together with the fans, sort of pleading there for their support despite these kind of nervous early beginnings, it seems.
Yeah, and he's had a lot of comparison to Jurgen Klopp, saying he gives off a similar vibe. He's created this sort of family atmosphere where everyone's open and honest. He's a motivator, he shouts a lot, but at the same time you can see that everybody's actually having fun and everyone's enjoying it. It's not like the sort of Rinus Michels days at Cologne, you know, where everybody's crying and being abused basically in training.
And throughout the kind of period of the 90s, that seems to be something that was just lacking whenever we were reading about this period, was just the idea of fun. It just seemed like a slide down, depressing, kind of desperate slide down the pyramid for FC Köln. But this seems to be a nice positive injection of good energy back to North Rhine-Westphalia.
Yeah, and you can see these links further with Klopp's idea of heavy metal football, as Cologne last season managed to have the lowest pressure per defensive action in the Bundesliga. Basically, the Billy Goats gave their opponents the least time on the ball before pressing, even outpressing the mighty Bayern Munich with 9.5 and Cologne with 9.2. Baumgart hasn't implemented any tactics that are super complex. The length and time of their passing sequences are average.
Meaning that they don't really try and keep hold of the ball all too much, but they press and they run and they use lots and lots of energy. And also, a nice little fun fact, Baumgart was the recipient of one of the best awards we've heard over here in Germany. He was awarded the best football saying of the year. So in the English translation, he had simply stated, and I think in a press conference, a game isn't over until the referee whistles and I stop yelling.
That's very good. That's very good. And that sort of brings us to the current season we find ourselves in now. And FC fans at the beginning had to deal with their leading talisman, Anthony Modeste, leaving for Borussia Dortmund in the last days of the transfer window as he filled the striker spot left by Sebastian Haller after his unfortunate cancer diagnosis at Dortmund. And Modeste, the former Blackburn loanee, some people might remember him being there, had scored 79 goals for Cologne across 2 spells. And since moving to Dortmund, I think he's scored like 2 goals, but a big one that I think will live in many Dortmund fans' heads is his 95th minute equaliser in the Clásico against Bayern Munich to make it 2-2. And of course, once again, we'll just mention the Modeste song from his time in Cologne.
That massive rave anthem that I'm sure goes off at the carnival time in FC Köln, or definitely did when he was still at the club.
Maybe he used to, maybe, yeah.
He played into these kind of Stefan Baumgart early tactics really well. As we said, they didn't really pass the ball too much. They ran and they pressed really hard. And to be honest, they loved throwing the ball deep into the box for Anthony Modeste to get his head on. He scored a number of headers and important goals for FC during his time at the club. But unfortunately, moving into the season, they had to kind of get over the hurdle of their losing their talisman.
When you look through the sort of the team stats, you can see no one's really stepped up to fill those goal-scoring shoes, with Florian Kainz being Cologne's top goalscorer with just 5 goals. Another factor this season is Cologne ended up being on the wrong side of final day drama as the last season came to a close. Stuttgart's 90th minute winner saved them from relegation, but also killed Cologne's chances at Europa League football as they dropped into the Europa Conference, but still, European football was back in Cologne.
considering their recent inconsistencies and stuttering to rebuild this fallen giant of a club, this is a very nice achievement that Stefan Baumgart had managed to produce here in North Rhine-Westphalia. However, this has kind of had an effect that you would expect on the season that's led to an intense and an inconsistent kind of up and down season as the Billy Goats sit currently mid-table.
Yeah, and they started the season being knocked out of the Pokal on penalties against Regensburg, but have navigated a qualifying tie versus MOL Fevre to confirm Conference League football.
They beat Schalke 04 on the opening day to get the season rolling in a good fashion, even beating local rivals Borussia Dortmund 3-2, but they also lost to local rivals Mönchengladbach 5-2 and got thumped 5-0 by Mainz, admittedly after falling down to 10 men.
Yeah, and all of this while competing with the sort of European midweek games in a group featuring Nice from France and Partizan Belgrade and Czech side Slovakia. And this tough running before the World Cup break did see them depart the Europa Conference League just 1 point short from squeezing through in second place. A 2-2 draw with Nice on the final match day saw them come from behind to draw, but it just wasn't enough to proceed to the knockout stage.
Hopefully the European nights have been a good reason to party and take that party atmosphere, that carnival atmosphere across the continent. And I hope it was a good kind of ground-hopping experience for what would be a starved kind of experience for modern-day FC Köln fans.
Yeah, something that they would have been so used to in the 70s, 80s. But another player that's really stood out for FC over the last season, Elias Skhiri, the French-born midfielder who represents Tunisia, provided the league's second-best rate of tackles per 1,000 opposition touches, plus the sixth-best rate of ball recoveries, while this season producing a brilliant amount of carries per 92.
New summer signing Linton Meiner from Hannover 96 has tried to fill this Anthony Modeste-shaped hole, producing a large amount of XG against his teammates. Florian Kainz also jumps out in these kind of metrics with impressive dribble numbers against his teammates, lots of carries, lots of chance-creating carries as well. And it seems like they've been producing the most amount of XG and shot-ending carries, all the good creative stuff you'd like to see from this FC team currently.
Yeah, and the squad also contains the likes of former Norwich loanee Andrzej Duda, ex-German international Jonas Hector is also the captain, and recent signing from Hertha Berlin, Davy Zelka. And Zelka is someone who was once described as a young Miroslav Klose. We'll be sort of keeping a close eye to see how he does in Cologne after previously not really living up to his billing and fulfilling his potential. And for example, he won the Golden Boot at the 2014 European Under-19 Championship as Germany won the competition, alongside like the likes of Julian Brandt and Joshua Kimmich. So yes, yeah, so we'll be keeping a close eye of how that move pans out.
With Stefan Baumgart's high-intensity running kind of style, we can imagine Davy Selke would fit into that seamlessly. He is definitely a player we've seen in Hertha. He plays with his heart on his sleeve, doesn't he? He's always like showing his emotion on the pitch, and I'm sure, just like Stefan Baumgart likes to show his emotion off the pitch, I'm sure they'll hit it off perfectly. After looking at the current season at FC Köln, we look towards the future of the club. What could be possible for the future of this huge club?
And with the Bundesliga being as ever competitive, with even the top spot potentially up for grabs this season, maybe, we don't want to curse anything, but Bayern Munich are only, what, 3-4 points ahead, and they don't have a goalkeeper at this point, so let's see. But there aren't many reasons why Cologne can't keep themselves on this stable path and why they can't continue to try and compete at a European level of some description, especially when you look at the likes of like Union Berlin getting back-to-back European seasons, Freiburg being so close to Champions League football, and when you compare these clubs to the history and the size of Cologne, there's no reason why they can't rebuild, and I don't know, maybe in the next few years, 5 to 10 years, maybe we have another glory period for Cologne, or at least a regular return to European football, you'd like to think.
I'm sure at this point FC Köln fans wouldn't be too mind to admit that even if Stefan Baumgart can achieve like half the success that Hennes Weisweiler had at the club, it would be another golden period for the Billy Goats, surely. Maybe after this hard season, this is obviously their return to European football, and it's been kind of like jumping in the cold end of the pool. They've had a shock coming back to European football with being knocked out in the group stage. So maybe one season out of it to rebuild under Stefan Baumgart might do them good. But then again, if they can just push on, we don't see why not. At the end of the day, they only outscore their XG by 3 goals, so it's not a massive overperformance to be worried about. So we hope that Stefan Baumgart could be given more resources to bring in some more stars so they don't have to depend on the likes of an Anthony Modeste figure, and so they can keep pushing up.
Yeah, and I think it's nicely sort of summed up in conclusion by the club's current sporting director, Jörg Jacobs. He says, after depressing times, including COVID and our performances on the pitch, he was able to inject so much energy, optimism and euphoria into the city, the club and the team, the players. Of course, this is a joint effort, but you need that initial spark, and that came from Stefan Baumgart. So yeah, so hopefully they can keep running with this, and yeah, we'll see more of Cologne in Europe over the coming seasons.
We'd like to say we'd love to try catch FC Köln if they are playing either of the two Berlin teams either during the rest of the season or in the future. That's definitely one for our ground hopping list, as well as also getting over to FC Köln's home stadium. That would be amazing as well. And for me, as I said at the very beginning of this two-part podcast series, I wasn't really sure why FC Köln were held up as such a huge club. But now, after reading the countless stories with Franz Kramer, Hennes Weisweiler, Hennes the Goat, also more importantly, it's the history there is writes itself with some amazing stories. Like my favourite, for example, was the goal difference deciding title from the end of part one, where they had to cling on for dear life with a goal difference of +3 to win their second Bundesliga title. Incredible, incredible.
Yeah, really enjoyed sort of learning more about them. Like we said at the beginning, like it's probably the club we've covered so far that I knew the least about, but it's been really interesting, really fascinating, and for me, even just getting to the bottom of why do they have a goat on their badge is something I had always wondered, and now we know. European nights against some of the great teams of like the Nottingham Forest side and against Barcelona and things. Yeah, great, great stories. And thanks for everybody, all Cologne fans that gave us a listen and entered our shirt competition.
As we like to do here, if you were there at the games, potentially, if you know someone who was, or to be honest, because we're just two guys who like to research and talk about football clubs, if we've got a little detail wrong, let us know on social media. Let us know your experiences. Let us know your stories. We love to read them in the comments below on either YouTube or on our social media. So please get involved, because we love to read everything about these clubs. Modest, Modest. From here, we depart FC Köln with our traditional link to our next episode, which will be episode 7. So we're doing something a little bit different for the link this time. So rather than a kind of little trivia question about who played who or who scored against who, we're going to tell you a player who is currently at the club we'll be covering next time out.
And the player we're talking about is Przemyslaw Wisniewski.
Przemyslaw Wisniewski. So the challenge here is if you could somehow translate the name we are saying here, which will give you a little hint, it's a Polish name. With the magic of audio editing, I'll put in like a text version here so our awful pronunciation doesn't slaughter it here.
Przemysław Wisniewski.
And this links to FC Köln in that he has shared a dressing room with none other than Prince Poldi at his hometown club of Górnik Zabrocka.
For this time, that pretty much rounds us up, doesn't it? And thanks everybody for listening. Please share it with your friends, fellow football fans. Let us know if any clubs you want us to cover in the future. And in the meantime, check out our social media. We might be giving away some more shirts. And yeah,
this has been the Journeyman Podcast, episode 6, signing out here at FC Köln. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
See you all next time.
Bye-bye.